Welcome to today's presentation, the 2014 Legislative Update for Law Enforcement. This webinar is broadcast live and brought to you by the Utah Prosecution Council, the Statewide Association of Prosecutors, and Utah Peace Officers Standards and Training. I'm Christopher Fielding of Post Technical Services, and I will be moderating today's webinar. We have also today with us Mark Nash, the Director of the Utah Prosecution Council, and he would like to give a few introductions to our presenters today. Mark?
Thank you, Chris. Welcome, everybody. Glad you're joining us. I am sorry that we're not able to do it in person. Financial restraints, as I explained in my letter, just made it so we couldn't do the 23 regionals we've been doing for a number of years. That's particularly sad for me because I've gotten to know all of you pretty well, and I wanted to do one last trip around the state before I hung it up, which I'll be doing at the end of this month, by the way. So for that purpose, before I go into the material, I want to introduce my successor who started work yesterday. Bob Church has been doing training for a long time. He's been a prosecutor in Orem City for a number of years, assistant city attorney as well. I was on the civil side there for a little while. He's also a full bird colonel in the JAG in the Utah National Guard. He came out after a fairly extensive interview and search effort by the Prosecution Council, and I'm very pleased to have Bob as my successor. I knew he'll do a good job. And Bob, you want to?
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. I look forward to getting to know most of you as I've seen who's checking in. It's nice to see some of the troopers that I've known from my career down in Orem, but I look forward to getting to meet and know most of you over the coming years. Thanks.
Okay. I want to thank the people whose names appear there on the title page, which is up on the screen right now. These summaries are prepared, especially this year, they were prepared in very short order between the end of the session and the end of March, essentially, because we had to have it ready for our spring conference, which took place last week. No two or three people could do this, and so I want to thank the people whose names appear there. They work for different entities. Their names, the entities for whom they work, is on the next page in. Without their efforts, this material could not have been prepared. If you go through the material, you'll note, if you download it, you will note that all of the bill numbers are underlined and hyperlinked. Well, they're hyperlinked. You can go to the full bill itself just by clicking on the bill number. So if you talking about HB 47. I don't know, and I don't even know whether we're going to be talking about HB 47, but if you want to see what it says, you can just click on the hyperlink and it takes you right to the enrolled version of the bill. There were two bills that were covered in the summaries that were vetoed. Those are marked by great big black vetoed letters over top of the bills, so you can, unless you really want to know the whole story behind them, you don't need to worry about those two bills. That's about it. I appreciate your attention and hope to see you around the state. Our presenters today are Paul Boyden. Paul is the executive director of the Statewide Association of Prosecutors. He does most of the legislative work for the prosecutors, has been doing that for many, many years. He's well known and well respected on the Hill, and he probably knows more war stories than you had time if we had four hours here instead of two, but we'll try to hold his war stories down. So, Paul, we're glad to have you. Chad Platt is an assistant deputy Salt Lake district attorney. He's been there for 12, 14 years, is it, Chad?
About
14. Chad is also the chair of the SWAP. That's the Statewide Association of Prosecutors, the SWAP Legislative Affairs Committee, and he works hard during the session and throughout the year on the bills and on legislation. So the two of them are very well qualified to talk about, to give the summaries. They're going to make do the summaries today. You're not going to hear any further from me. Thanks for your attention, and we'll turn it over to those guys.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, okay then.
Well, I think we're ready to dive right on in.
I'm afraid we are. So here goes. We'll start with House Bill 11. this is overdose reporting amendments. This was a very high profile and high priority for the treatment folks and for all of us, really, because we've had a number of instances, and unfortunately these happen more often now, of people who experience an overdose, and everyone who is there is afraid to call for emergency help because they're afraid that they'll be charged with a crime, or they're afraid that the person who's overdosing will be charged with a crime, and then they end up dying. And that is, that's happened a sad number of times, and it's happened throughout the country. So throughout the country, there have been so-called Good Samaritan laws, which have been passed. We have seen them all over the place. The one in New Jersey was of got particular notoriety because Governor Christie was going to veto it and then decided not to after he learned a little bit more about it. So we decided that it would be far better if we got on the front end of this and worked on it. So we need to understand that the public policy here is to encourage people to call for emergency help when somebody appears to be overdosing. On the other hand, we didn't want to create any real problems. So what we have is what's called an affirmative defense, which means it's a complete defense, really, to possession of controlled substances, and that would include possession of less than 16 ounces of marijuana. And so what happens is if you fit six criteria, then you can't be prosecuted for possession. Okay, and the first thing is they reasonably believe that the person, that somebody, is experiencing an overdose due to the use of controlled substance, and then they make a report in good faith. And that includes, of course, either the person who is reporting or the person who is the subject of the report. Neither one can be charged. Now, other folks that are hanging around will probably split anyway, so that won't be much of an issue. Then they have to give a functional description of the actual location. They have to remain at the location. They have to cooperate with the responding medical provider. And all this has to happen, of course, in the same course of events for which the overdose arose. And we have strange language like that. Just to keep it from being abused, the statute from being abused. And one thing that we put in here is that, and we got this from another state, and I'd really like to know the backstory on this. This has got to be good. So good faith under this amendment does not include seeking medical assistance during the course of the execution of a search warrant or an arrest warrant or a lawful search. So somebody crashes in the front door and they say, oh, hey, man, I think somebody around here is overdosing. Sure glad you came. So, you know, that's not going to work. Anyhow, well, that works as far as possession. Well, what about if somebody is sharing or distribution, or if it's a drug house or whatever? Well, what you have then is a mitigating factor. Now, you go through the same criteria, and you can still charge them with distribution, but these are mitigating factors. Now, what happens when you have a situation where you got a couple of kids that are sharing? Are you going to charge one of them with distribution, even though he called? Well, okay, we'll use some sense and say no. Probably we're not going to, because the overall public policy here is to encourage them to call in. So even though we maybe could charge them, in a lot of cases we won't. But we'll take that on a case-by-case basis, you know, and decide what's just and the time. That's why we can't use holograms for police and prosecutors. That's we prefer to have real people who make good decisions. The effective date of that was March 20th of 2014 when it was signed by the governor. Chad, I think you're up.
Okay. You know, maybe I'll mention I'm going to be at HB 16. I think the effective date for the majority of the legislation we talk about is going to be May 13. But otherwise, if there's a different effective date, such as upon the signature of the governor or July 1 or some other date, we'll let you know as we're going through it. But keep in mind, most of these will be May 13 unless we say otherwise. HB 16 is titled Wrongful Lien Amendments, and this is something that is they've done amendments to this law this year to specifically try and address issues where either a law enforcement officer or a public official, a prosecutor, an officer, somebody is having a wrongful lien filed against them. What usually happens is somebody that has been that feels that they've been abused by some political figure or some public official will go down to the courthouse or go down to the county recorder, and they'll file a document filing a lien, pretending as though they have some right against that person's property. And they do that really just to bother them and just to cause a hardship for that public official. And that would be a third-degree felony if they do it having no objectively reasonable basis to believe that they have a present lawful property interest in the property or claim on the assets. And the important thing for law enforcement to know as you listen to this is that the term public official is defined in this amendment this year includes but is not limited to members of law enforcement, corrections officers, and active members of the Utah State Bar, which would include both prosecutors and defense attorneys and any other members of the Utah State Bar. But again, that's what we're driving at is these kind of revenge wrongful liens that are being filed, and that would be a third-degree felony. Turning all the way over to the bottom of page 7, we generally have one of these bills a year anymore since the scourge of both spice and bath salts have been around, and of course we're always trying to keep up with the changes and the modifications in the actual chemical structure and having those actual chemical structures be defined within our listed substances statute. And so what HB 30 does is it simply adds new versions of spice to the list of controlled substances, and you can go to that statute and read it if you have one of those cases. Turning all the way over now to page 10, and this is House Bill 53. At the top of the page there's restitution amendments, and this is an interesting bill that came to us just shortly before the session began, and I called it a simple twist of fate, but in reality what happened was you had a juvenile, so a non-adult, who had killed somebody, and they had agreed to plead guilty to a manslaughter within the juvenile system, and as part of the sentence, they went to the secure facility. The problem was that under Title 78A, 6120, which is under the juvenile statute, it required that the jurisdiction of the juvenile court terminate upon sending that juvenile to the secure facility. And we had a defense attorney successfully argue that the $5,000 in fees, or not fees, I should say, $5,000 in funeral costs for the person that the juvenile had killed, that they could, the court could not impose that as restitution. And in fact, the court bought off on that argument and said, well, until you change the statute and make it so that we can hold on to restitution and make those orders, then that's correct. And so this bill, we were happy to see this get through this year, and it allows the courts to make and enforce orders of restitution despite having sent the juvenile to a secure facility.
House Bill 70 is probably one of the most telling examples of the mood of the legislature and, in fact, kind of the general public these days.
Would you call that a good mood?
No. I think we'd want to we want to thank the NSA and Edward Snowden for helping us all out and making everybody paranoid about their government. nonetheless, this was a bill which was started by the libertarians and to show just kind of the way these things go. We had libertarians on one side, you know, extremely conservative and extremely liberal. you know how the political spectrum work. If you go far enough to either edge, they meet around the back. And that's kind of what happens here. And so this had this was sponsored by a very conservative Republican in the House and a very liberal Democrat in the Senate. And it has to do with making forcible entry and arrests. Now, when they first started working on this, I think one thing that fueled the fire was the awful situation which we had in Ogden, where Officer Franken was killed. And that was a situation where it was a knock and announce search warrant, and they went and knocked for quite a while, and it gave the the subject of the search, the guy in the house, the opportunity to arm himself and barricade himself. So when they finally went in, he started shooting, and that's the way the rest of it went. Well, not everybody sees it that way. In fact, there was a even while we were talking about this at the legislature, we had some people saying that this was and they acted as though it was just the sound of breaking glass that woke him up, and so just to protect himself from what he thought was the gangs intruding, he pulled out his weapon, etc. Well, you can choose who you want to believe on that particular issue. But that's the way these things got kicked off, and, you know, there's a lot of that. And you can all you have to do is read some of the postings on the net, and, of course, you can read just about anything there. And but that's kind of the general mood. Well, once we got in a situation where we were where we were negotiating with everybody, and we finally got down to sticking with actual facts, perhaps, with the state of the law, there were a lot of changes made, and so we were able to work on this a lot. But still, there was a mood trying to being very concerned about police intrusions of one kind and another. So there you have it. That's just a mood of the year. So what we ended up with, here's kind of an interesting thing. You know, when you're in political negotiations and the ACLU has a moderating effect, I think that kind of tells you how far things have gone. So anyway, that was our experience this year. So force in making arrest. If you're making an arrest, and we'll just go to what the statute says now. When you're making an arrest, what we ended up with is we have a couple of separate sections, one dealing with the force which can be used in making an arrest, and that is if you have evidence that might be quickly destroyed, you have to have probable cause. That would be the standard. You have probable cause that if you're going to enter a building to make an arrest, probable cause that evidence is going to be destroyed. However, if you're talking about safety of either the officer or anybody else, then the standard there is a reason to believe that someone might be injured. So it's a slightly lower standard if you're talking public safety. The practical difference, probably not much, if any. Nonetheless, that's the way it is in the statute. You have pretty much the same standards when you're talking about entering to execute a search warrant. And again, you have reason to believe that there may be a danger to the life or safety of the officer or another person. Then you can go ahead and enter without notice. Or if you have probable cause that evidence might be destroyed. And those standards are now required for the issuance of a search warrant. So when you go on to e-warrants and you go through the templates, sometime starting about July, you're going to, right, Chad?
July 1.
Chad is kind of the guy who puts those templates together. You'll see a difference there in the standards in the templates that you use when you're getting a search warrant, at least as the part that has to do with getting a no-knock warrant. Now, this doesn't just have to do with the no-knock warrants. If you have a knock-and-announce warrant and you go up to the door and at that point you get information that you didn't have previously, either that there is danger to someone if you don't bust right in, or that they're going to be destroying evidence and you've got probable cause to believe that, which you may not have had before, then you can go ahead and enter without without the knock and announce business. But when you do go in, you still have to announce yourself as soon as you can. And now, of course, that's exactly what you do because you don't want to get shot. So when you break down the door, you yell police search warrant, which, of course, is standard procedure, which is going to be followed. And also there's some language in here that officers in doing any of these things use only that force which is reasonable and necessary. Well, of course, that was already the standard anyway. But so that's kind of the saga that we went through on the forcible entry provisions in House Bill 70. That bill will be effective on July 1st. We got them to delay the effective date so that Chad and his friends could put together the templates for the electronic warrants.
Yeah,
and you're lucky if you can get them done by then.
I think we're going to be able to get them done. And if I can just, maybe since this is going out to law enforcement, and I'm sure they're familiar with going into the e-warrant system, how we envision this happening is there's a wizard that when you hover over an area, the computer pops up kind of an instruction or will tell you what's being asked for within the e-warrant. What we plan on doing is at a minimum of putting there the different standards. So if you're in that section that you're trying to apply for a no-knock warrant, and you're doing it because it's a danger, then you, the wizard would tell you the new standard, or not the new standard, the old standard that's always been in place. But if you're doing it for, because you think the evidence is going to be destroyed, the wizard will say, okay, you need to make sure you have probable cause when you're describing, which would be very specific facts about how you believe or know that evidence would be destroyed if you were to wait. So anyway, look for that changes to that wizard section.
Okay, House Bill 71, distribution of intimate images. This is a revenge porn bill. Now, those of you who may not be familiar with what revenge porn is, who've been living in a cave recently, revenge porn is some intimate images, naked pictures mostly, of either selfies or taken of each other during intimate moments. Usually shared by a loving couple who then becomes not so loving and they break up. And so in order to get back at the unrequited love story, one person puts it on the internet, usually accompanied with information about the person whose image is being put on the internet, and essentially making their life extremely miserable. Now, yeah, it's true. People ought to have enough sense not to do this in the first place. But on the other hand, this is really an awful thing to do. So personally, I don't get the intimate image business. But, you know, what can I say? So anyway, so the elements of this offense are that the actor commits the offense of distribution of intimate images. The actor has the intent to cause emotional distress or harm, and they knowingly, intentionally distribute to a third party the intimate image of a person who is 18 years of age or older. Why 18 or over? Because if they are distributing naughty pictures of people who are under 18, we've got far higher penalties under other sections. Okay, so anyway, the actor knows that the depicted individual has not given consent, and individual who is who's depicted has a reasonable expectation of privacy, and there is some actual emotional distress or harm that's caused. There is a broad definition of distribute, and if you want to read some really disgusting stuff, you can look at the definition of what an intimate image is. And those of you who are attending this in a darkened basement, I'm sure will feel free to go ahead and do that. Internet service providers had some well-paid lobbyists and some really swell exclusions for this. So if you own your own ISP, you don't need to worry too much about this unless you are directly involved with the intent to cause harm. The penalty for that is a Class A misdemeanor and a second or subsequent offense is a third-degree felony. Now, there is a bill which we accidentally left out, and that was House Bill 75, and that bill is restoration of civil rights for nonviolent felons. This is a gun bill. You can tell because it's sponsored by Representative Oda, and it's talking about civil rights. That's how you know it's the gun people, because you know what they say about how the ACLU counts to 10.
No, I don't.
1, 3, 4, 5.
Right.
If you don't get that, the person next to you is going to elbow you. Okay. anyway, the what this has to do with is, first of all, to conform to the federal. This has to do with restricted persons under state law. And the first feature of the bill is to conform it to the exceptions that there are in federal law, and that is that a conviction of a felony does not include conviction for antitrust, unfair trade practices, restraint of trade, etc. Any of those, and then we put in not involving theft or fraud. So there you go. I don't know how often you're going to run into this on the street. Probably not every day. The other thing, though, is if the person has a prior conviction which has been expunged either in this state or another state or another jurisdiction, could be federal, or it could have been pardoned or reduced to a misdemeanor, etc. And if that happened, it's possible that you could pull up an arrest record on somebody when it has actually been expunged or otherwise reduced in the state of origin. So, so how are you going to know that? Well, you're not. And so, what we also asked to put in here is that the defendant has the burden of providing some evidence that it was reduced or or expunged in the other state. And then once they do that, then, of course, the state would have to prove, well, no, that didn't happen. So that's the way that one goes.
Page 13 at the top is House Bill 80. And I like the fact that it's House Bill 80 because it has to do with an 80-mile speed limit, which has been increasing over the last several years, as we've noticed. What this bill does is it now says that on any freeway or limited access highway, the speed limit can be increased to 80 miles per hour so long as a traffic engineering and safety study has been conducted and says that that should be the speed limit. So we're just increasing the speed here in Utah. I love it. I have to admit that. I'm from Arizona, and boy, they drive slow down there. So I like the changes. HB 85, the Grand Canyon State. It's something else. Exception to e-filing requirements for citation and accident reports. This is important to note, especially in the rural areas, as a peace officer, because everything's changing to this new e-filing world. And what HB 85 says is that when issuing a citation, it is expected or required that you do that electronically now, that you file the citation electronically. This bill recognizes that there may be some exceptions to that. For example, if you have no access to the e-filing system because you're in a canyon somewhere or you're in a smaller law enforcement agency and you don't have access for those reasons, this bill would then at least recognize that there are some exceptions to the requirement that you e-file your citations. Turning to bottom of page 14 is House Bill 101, which I call HOBO 101, the HB standing for HOBO. And what this is Provo already has these laws in place, and essentially these are being adopted now so that they can be applied statewide. And what's trying to be addressed here is a feeling that there's a danger when you have people near a highway, near a freeway, or in the middle of a divided highway that are soliciting contributions or picketing or doing any number of things. So roadway and sidewalk safety amendments describes the following crimes. An individual cannot engage in conduct that impedes or blocks traffic within the area of an interstate, freeway, highway, including the shoulders, on ramps and off-ramps. And so we can picture the situation, and some of us have felt uncomfortable. You're getting off the off-ramp, and you see the guy on the side that's holding the sign that says hungry or lost my job, and he's trying to solicit from the drivers there. Well, that would be considered impeding traffic and a safety issue under this new law. You can see the list there of if you have a chance to glance at this: loitering, demonstrating or picketing, distributing materials, holding signs. The bill adds the following prohibited activity, which is interesting. And this has to do with banks specifically. And that is that they wanted to prohibit somebody from aggressively trying to solicit money from near ATMs. So if you're within 10 feet of a bank entrance or within 10 feet of an automatic teller machine and the person is persisting in approaching people and trying to ask for money, or they're engaging in any conduct that would cause that person to fear harm, or they're blocking the path of an individual, all of those would be a Class C misdemeanor as well. So this is the way that we're attacking our hobo problem here in the state of Utah. Plant extract amendments is the top of page 16, and while this is a pretty momentous bill, when you get down to it, I did the summary on this, and I did a short summary because its application is going to be so very narrow, but it is an important bill, especially when you just think about the fact that in the state of Utah, some form of marijuana is lawful after HB 105. And of course, what they've done to narrow it is that this provides an exception under 5837-8 to being charged with a crime for possession if the following things apply. This would only apply to hemp extract, and that's the kind of marijuana that has almost no THC, but is very high in cannabidiol, which is what makes people really calm when they're on marijuana, I guess. So what this says is if you're either a person or you're a parent administering to a child who has been diagnosed by a neurologist with intractable epilepsy. So this is only a bill that will apply to that very narrow set of individuals. Either the child has an intractable epilepsy and the parent has the marijuana on them, or the person has intractable epilepsy themselves. And then in addition to that, they have to be registered with the Department of Health as one of those people. They have to have a card issued by the Department of Health, and they have to have that hemp extract in its original sealed prescribed container. So all of those things for this exception to being charged with a crime would apply. The effective date on this is July 1, 2014. But nonetheless, still quite amazing that we have some form of marijuana that's lawful here in Utah.
It was very compelling evidence. They had recordings of kids going through these seizures. That was really heartrending. So that one was was bound to pass no matter what, I think. House Bill 119, Opiate Overdose Emergency Treatment. This actually is going to make Narcan, that's the trade name, for naloxone hydrochloride or other opiate antagonists, makes it more available by prescription. So a medical provider provides education to a person, gives them a prescription, and so this will be available in situations where somebody may be a caregiver for somebody who is likely to overdose or whatever, or maybe a public safety people. So you may be one of those. first responders are really a very good candidate for having Narcan, and probably some of you already have it. And what happens is if you, once you take the training, you have the prescription, and then you administer this to somebody who apparently is suffering from an opiate overdose, you also have immunity from civil liability, which is a good thing.
Very good. House Bill 128, bottom of page 18, is electronic device location amendments. And so addressing, you know, all of the investigations that you do, detectives out there who I'm sure in the past have used cell phone pinging to try and locate somebody, or maybe you've attached a GPS device to the bottom of a vehicle in a drug investigation. This bill is one of the most impactful bills that we've had this session. And at first glance, it looks like it's going to be a hassle, but it really isn't too bad, although there are some differences in the way that you're going to be doing things.
It was a lot worse before Chad negotiated with them.
Yeah, it began really, really poorly. Again, this is tracks along with HB 70 that Paul just talked about. There are about four bills that the legislature was directing toward search warrants generally because of the, would you call it a great perception that the legislature has of law enforcement this year?
I'd just call it a perception.
A perception, mm-hmm. Okay. So let's look at the definition here of an electronic device. Under this 77, it's a new section entirely called 7723C-101, and it has a number of different sections. An electronic device means a device that enables access to or use of an electronic communication service, remote computing service, or location information service. So this is going to include a cellular phone and a GPS device. And it would include, I kind of thought through this before it could be asked, it would include a GPS device owned by the agency. And then the question comes, well, what if you attach your own GPS device, say, to an agency-owned bicycle because you want to, you know, set up some kind of sting operation that way? Well, because of this new law, you would still have to get a warrant before you do that. The reason for that is the definition of location information means information concerning the location of an electronic device that in whole or in part is generated or derived from or obtained by the operation of the electronic device. So those are pretty broad definitions. We're talking about both the cell phone and the GPS device here. 7723C102, this new statute would say, except as provided in subsection 2, a government entity may not obtain the location information, stored data, or transmitted data of any electronic device without a search warrant issued by a court upon probable cause. Now, this is going to have an effective date of July 1 as well, which gives me hopefully enough time to put together two templates that you should be seeing in e-warrants by July 1. And that would be one for cellular phones, if you're going to do a pinging search warrant to ping somebody's phone and try and triangulate on it, and then the other being the GPS device that you're going to attach to something. Now, the sponsor of this bill, Representative Wilcox, I should point out, his job is in the telecommunication industry. And it took me a while to understand what he was getting at here. But within the bill, it says that the law enforcement agency is required to destroy information that is gathered as part of the search warrant if it belongs to a third party. And what the representative believed was happening, and I don't know whether this is the case or not, but maybe you as law enforcement do know, he gave the example that if you were going to track a cell phone that with a search warrant, that you would also be getting information from every other search cell phone within the area. Again, I don't know if that's the case or not, but what this bill would say is that you would have to destroy that third-party data, not the data that came as a product of the warrant, but any other data that you got, if that's happening. And then finally, this is the part that's going to be the most annoying. Maybe I'll put it that way. It has notice requirements that you've never had before. So right now, if you're in a drug investigation and you do a GPS device and magnetic and attach it to the car, you gather your evidence and you file your search warrant return, etc., and nothing happens after that. The new requirement will be that a government entity that executes a warrant pursuant to this new statute shall, within 14 days after the day on which the operation concludes, issue a notification to the owner of the device specified within the warrant that states that the warrant was applied for and granted, the kind of warrant it was, the period of time during which you were collecting data, the offense, the identity of of your entity, and the identity of the judge, which I'm sure judges are going to appreciate all of these letters going out, indicating that they've approved these warrants. But in any case, you need to do that within 14 days of when the operation concludes. And we did have testimony at committee hearing that when they say operation concludes, they mean your entire investigation. There is an opportunity to apply to delay that notification if it's necessary, but just know that even if you were to delay it, once your operation is over, if you have that cell phone warrant or you have that GPS warrant, you need to send out first-class mail this letter to the owner of the device, whoever that is. And I think in most cases, that's just going to be a letter that probably ends up coming back to you because most drug dealers don't put cell phones in their own name. At least that's been my experience. So be aware of a number of changes there with electronic devices that are on the horizon as of July 1.
Okay, House Bill 137, amendments to driver's license sanction. a couple of years ago, there was a bill which put some, I think what we'd have to call draconian licensing restrictions on kids who are convicted of possession or consumption of alcohol. And it's kind of been a bit much. And as you know, the and we've had police officers call us regarding this and saying, can't we do something? Because we've got these kids that are really getting in more trouble because they don't have the license and they think their lives are over. Which, of course, I guess is true if you're a teenager. So anyway, this was not a really big deal, but I think we've finally gone through in a couple of bills have kind of taken this back to where it's really pretty rational. And this is kind of an interesting one. Now, this has to do only with non-driving, okay? So they weren't driving in the first place. This isn't a DUI, but this was possession of alcohol by a minor. So what you essentially end up with is a one-year hard suspension. And we say hard suspension because they can't get their license back in less than a year. But but it can go for 2 years. And so what happens is that if the violation is is the second or subsequent offense for violating one of those sections, the minor is 18 years of older or older, that the minor provides a sworn statement that the minor has been alcohol free for a year. Now, what checks do we have on it? Well, seriously, do you want to have these kids come in for a UA and mix with all the other folks that are coming in for a UA? I think not. So we really said, okay, that's fine. Just go ahead and they'll give a sworn statement, and maybe that'll give them at least some motivation to actually be alcohol-free. And then, of course, if the kid is still under 18, then the parents sign the sworn statement on that one. So, anyway, that was effective on April 1st, and I'm not fooling about that. April 1st, which is when the governor signed it. And now we're going way over to page 26. What about those rape kids, Chad?
Okay, I was just Officer Jorgensen, we see your question out there, and I'm going to address that in just a minute. But let me do this first, and then we'll pull up. Or do we do this at the end? The question.
No, go ahead and do it while it's topical.
Okay. So the question is a warrant necessary for a cellular device in the case of search and rescue? And last year they actually had a bill that addresses that directly, and it was to the telecom industries saying that if it's a matter of life and death, then the cellular provider must provide that information without a warrant. And I think that is still going to apply. The Section 2 that is referred to in the summary there is a government entity may obtain location information without a warrant for an electronic device in accordance with 5310.104.5. And I believe that's the section that I'm referring to, but I'd have to check that, and that's why I was going to check it and just make sure that's the case. And then it also has, if the device is state-owned or is being used by a state employee, and what that was for is so that employers can check the devices of the people that they employ, and they provide the cellular phone to them. But there's a couple of exceptions there, and the short answer is I think that a search and rescue operation would be one of the exceptions. Rape kit processing amendments is a bill that has a curious new requirement for those that are investigating sexual offenses. And I kind of usually do a dunk-dunk, which is the Law and Order sound, because it makes me think of the SVU unit in the program there. And they always have a discussion about rape kits on SVU unit. And this is talking about rights of the victim to know about their case and be informed by law enforcement about major things that are happening. So the first thing that tells law enforcement is that the agency may notify the victim of the following things. So this is discretionary on your part: whether a DNA profile was obtained from the rape kit or other evidence in the case, whether the DNA profile was entered into the CODIS system, whether there's a match between the DNA and another DNA profile, and that they have a right to designate, meaning the victim has a right to designate a person to act on their behalf. So that's all discretionary. But if a law enforcement agency investigating the sexual offense determines that DNA will not be analyzed, it must notify the victim of that decision. So if for some reason, while you're doing the case, you decide, well, there's no reason to analyze this DNA, then you need to notify the victim of that fact. And then it also has this curious language in here. And what's curious about it is it says the law enforcement agency that intends to destroy rape kit evidence or crime scene evidence from a sexual assault investigation must, 60 days prior to that destruction, provide written notice to the victim of the intent and provide information on how to appeal the decision to destroy it. And then what's most curious is they don't define what it means to appeal that decision. They don't say what that procedure might be. So I guess that's left up to the law enforcement agency to create that appellate process. But my guess is it's going to involve the prosecutor's office, since Title 77, Chapter 24, deals with items that are no longer needed as evidence, and that you go through the prosecutor before you get a letter saying that it can be destroyed. So I'm guessing that would be your appellate process.
Okay. On page 28, House Bill 185, Juvenile Detention Facilities. very interesting bill. This was run by the Division of Juvenile Justice Services. We have an interesting situation right now in that JJS actually has considerable capacity. Usually everything is overcrowded, and you're moving from one overcrowded facility to another. JJS does have some capacity to back this up, which is a great thing. This has to do only with those minors who are moved into the adult criminal system to be tried as an adult. And the question is, where do you keep them before trial? And that's all this has to do with. and the answer to that is, you keep them now, you keep them in the juvenile facility in secure care, unless the judge says, no, that's not what we're going to do. so how do we, how is that decision made? Well, there are several ways that that a minor can be moved from the juvenile system to the adult system. The first one is, of course, direct filing. And that has to do with if they have been charged with murder, aggravated murder, or if they've committed a felony while they were in secure care, or that sort of thing. So there are a few ways of doing that. And so they will be kept in the juvenile facility, but as soon as this charge is filed and gets before the district court judge, the district court judge has to make the decision whether that juvenile is going to be kept in the juvenile facility or in the jail. Now, the problem with keeping them in the jail is that the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and not only that, but good common sense, says that you don't mix those minors with the adult population in the jail. They are very impressionable, and that's one way to make a delinquent kid into a criminal in a big fat hurry, is to mix them in. And so the next worst thing, and which is the common practice, is to keep them in essentially what is solitary confinement, and that doesn't do them any good either. So that's the idea. We'll keep them in the juvenile facility if we can. Well, on the other hand, some of these kids can be very dangerous, and if they're really bad, then you don't want them mixing with the other juveniles either. And so in that situation, well, better that they be in solitary confinement in the jail than that they be in making a mess out of some of the other kids in secure care facility. Well, tough call. And this is to be made, of course, by a judge. So if it's a direct file, like I was mentioning, then the district court judge has to make that decision as soon as possible, which is at the initial appearance. And there's not a default position, so the judge has to make a decision one way or the other. If they don't make a decision, you have to go back to them and say, so tell us, judge, which place are they going to be? We need the order now. and then if you're talking about serious youth offender or a certification procedure, in either one of those cases, you have the juvenile court judge has been dealing with them, And if it's at the end of the prelim under a serious youth offender or after a certification hearing under the certification procedure, then the juvenile court judge, when they bind them over to district court for trial, has to make that decision immediately. But that's kind of a temporary decision, and it can be reviewed at any time by the district court judge. So that's probably a very good thing, and we'll see how that turns out. Now, the next thing is House Bill 190, breathalyzer amendments. From what we understand, there have been breathalyzers, which are being made available in alcohol retail licensees of the state, in other words, bars. And some of these are of questionable accuracy. Nonetheless, they've been a popular thing to distribute or to have available in some bars. If I owned a bar, there's no way on earth that I would have one of those things just for the liability, but there they are anyway. So I think some folks from the industry approached when I say industry, I'm talking about the breathalyzer industry, approached Representative Hughes and said, you know, if they're going to have them, then they ought to be accurate. And he thought, you know, that's really a very good thing. So I said, and that was the original point of the bill. So it has it has to either be a fuel sensor technology like your intoxilizers, or it has to, or a class one medical device with at least 99.18% accuracy, having a detection cutoff at 0.08. Well, okay, that's swell. But now the next question is, why do we really want them, these things in the bar anyway? Does this mean that it's going to all turn into a drinking game, or that it has done in the past, where they drink until they're up to a 0.07 9 or whatever it is, and say, nope, I'm still under an 08, so I'm good to go? Well, we know that that's just flat out not true, because anybody at a 0.05 or over, we know that they're not capable of safely operating a motor vehicle. The reason we're still at an 08 is because enforcement is just awful. You know, how are you really going to prove it? Field sobriety tests, you know, are pretty much geared to a higher BA than that. Sure, you can use the roadside deals. What do you call them? Somebody tell me quick.
The field sobriety test?
No.
The breathalyzer?
Somebody is going to type that. It's going to send that right in. I've just had a blank. Well, anyway, so you can use them. And, yeah, that might work. But anyway, so what are we going to do about having these things in there? Has somebody done it? Yeah, PBT. Thank you, Matt Miller, UHP. Woo! Whew. Man. anyway, so what we did is went to the sponsor and asked them to require that if they're going to have these things in the bars, that they put a warning on it that says, quote, the National Transportation Safety Board has found that crash risk is consistently and significantly elevated by the time an individual reaches a blood alcohol content of 0.05. So they're going to have to read that when they do it. So we thought, hey, you know, what's to lose? Now, by the way, breathalyzer was once a trade name. It was Dr. Borkenstein's invention, and apparently it has now turned into pretty much a generic name for any breath testing equipment.
Interesting. I always know it as a general name. I'll be at a
Well,
top...
that's your generation.
Well,
man.
So there you go. Yeah. top of page 30 is HB 200. I will mention that I looked up the 5310 104.5, and it is wireless service call location in emergencies on that last question, and that is the section that that bill was referring to. So no, you do not need a warrant
for search and rescue.
For search and rescue.
We can all breathe easy.
Excellent. Unlawful removal or vandalism of campaign signs is just a quick one, fun one. HB 200 says that it's a Class B misdemeanor to either deface a campaign sign for public office or to remove one. And so don't be, you know, drawing a mustache on somebody's campaign sign. HB.
What if it's an improvement?
Well, and I think in a lot of them it might be.
Well, anyway.
HB 212, DNA collection amendments, is a very simple bill as well, and the summary is actually well done, and it's very simple in this sense. Currently, you, or as of May of this year, you may discretionarily obtain a DNA sample upon the arrest of somebody for a felony, but as of January 1 of 2015, as soon as the new year starts, law enforcement must collect DNA samples at the time of booking for any felony offense.
Okay, we're going to go back to the breathalyzer issue. Trooper Miller has said that still doesn't take into account if drinkers are taking impairing medications. Oh, that's so true. And that's not the only thing it doesn't take into account. If somebody is drinking up to a certain point while they're still in the bar, and they haven't processed all that stuff into their blood yet, their blood obviously can go up, and I think we're all quite aware of that. And it's not in the summary here, but the statute does require that there's also a notice in there that says that. That your blood alcohol may go up if you have consumed alcohol that hasn't made it into your bloodstream yet. That's in essence what it says. It's, you know, not verbatim, clearly. And then, of course, if you combine even low levels of alcohol with medication, you can be blotto at a very low level. Okay, House Bill 213, criminal penalties for sexual contact with a student. We're going to have to read this along with before we get to that, DNA collection. Chad, Jeff Smith says, what kind of DNA sample and who collects it?
You know, I think that's always been a buccal swab at the station as they're being booked, and I was just looking at the bill itself, and I don't see any changes to what's normally done. The bill only talks about time periods, so whatever has been happening continues, and this just addresses the time periods.
So you don't recommend shaving off a piece of skin or anything?
Well, it depends on the offender.
Maybe a lock of hair.
Yeah.
No. Will jails be tasked with that, like fingerprinting?
Well, and again, the current law is when a sheriff books a person for any offense under subsections, it's a
yeah.
Then the sheriff, and so it's talking about the sheriff shall obtain a DNA specimen from the person upon the booking of the person in the county jail. And it doesn't specify, and I think they've always done buccal swabs when they've done this.
But to the question of whether it's the sheriff at the jail who stuck with it, I think that's a yes.
Yes.
Okay, House Bill 213 and House Bill 257. These are some are two bills that we'll kind of look at in conjunction with each other. And I'll start with House Bill 257, and that is last May there was a Supreme Court case which was State versus Watkins. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that that a certain statute which says that child sex abuse is enhanced to aggravated child sex abuse if the person is in a position of authority, the court held that the state not only had to prove that they were in a position of authority, but in addition, that the defendant, that position of authority gave the defendant the ability to exercise undue influence over the victim. Well, we weren't going to put up with that for very long, and so we ran a bill changing it to say that if they were on that list, of positions of special authority that was a position of special authority. And then we had a residual category that says that if they otherwise are in a position that allows them to exercise undue influence, then that would also be a position of special trust. This is very important because it not only makes a difference in those kinds of charges, but when you have other kinds of charges, where the question is, did a person under 18 give permission for the intercourse type of activity? this list has, for many years, been proof positive that no, they didn't give permission because of the position of special trust. Okay, well, now we're going to go back to House Bill 213 for criminal penalties for sexual contact with a student. And what this bill did, and this was Representative Christensen's, which was a separate bill, this was not a swap bill. The first one I mentioned was a swap bill, meaning our association wrote it and asked for it. This one was not, although we did work with Representative Christensen on it. this was not our idea, and we had some question about enhancing one particular kind of special trust and not the others. But at any rate, here's the bill, and that has to do with teachers. And so rather than just saying a teacher, it now says a teacher or any other person employed by or volunteering at a private or public elementary school or secondary school, and who is 18 years of age or older. So that's a new expanded category. Now, also, sexual abuse of a minor statute, which essentially deals with touching offenses, makes it a crime for a teacher or any of the others in that category to have sexual contact, which would be a Class A for anyone else, and it is a third-degree felony for teachers. So there you go. And if you are investigating a case of that type having to do with teachers, you'll want to take a look at that bill, House Bill 213, because there are other things in there, including a new section having to do with victims who are 16 or 17, enrolled students, et cetera. So there is a lot in there, and you want to go over that with your prosecutors if you have a case where you're investigating a teacher.
Okay. HB 254 on page 33 is human trafficking amendments. And so I have a way for law enforcement to keep this one in mind, and that is if you think of the song by The Police, right, so that's appropriate. Roxanne, and it's actually very appropriate to think about, because what this bill is saying is that if you are investigating or you come across a juvenile, 17 years or younger person who is committing an act of prostitution, they get one bite at the apple under this new law. And what I mean by that is that the first time a child or a minor is referred to DCFS for services under circumstances where they're being investigated for an act of prostitution, they cannot be charged with that crime. In other words, you have to have reported them to DCFS first. They have to have received services first for an act of prostitution before on the second time you could actually charge that juvenile in the juvenile court for an act that would be a crime. And that's why I think of the song by Police, Roxanne, because it has you don't have to put on the red light, Roxanne, you don't have to sell your body to the night, and the whole song is about trying to tell the young lady that she can change her lifestyle. And what this bill is intended to do is have the police do that, well, at least one time first with a juvenile before they actually get charged with that crime. That's that one.
House Bill 268, Dangerous Weapons Amendments. Okay, This is one that you are going to want to know a little bit about, okay? Now, the initial purpose of this bill was to let restricted persons possess archery equipment, and that would include crossbows, either for target shooting or hunting. Now, what can you hunt with a crossbow? If you're disabled and you have a prescription, essentially, you can hunt big game with a crossbow. Otherwise, though, there are lots of non-game animals that can be hunted with a crossbow. And so that was the idea, was to allow restricted persons to do that. Now, I'm not sure exactly why it's that important for restricted persons. And when we say that, that means people who otherwise can't have a weapon because they've been found incompetent or because they have been convicted of a felony, you know, those sections, they should be able to possess a crossbow. Okay. Well, that was one thing. But then it got even more interesting because the sponsor decided that he wanted to take a look at dangerous weapons, which are not firearms, and adjust the definition. So we had an ongoing dialogue on this issue, and so this is the way that it ends up, okay? And this is new and different, okay? Firearms are, after the effective date, which will be May 13th, the standard one, firearms will be per se dangerous weapon, okay? But there is a section in there that talks about a knife or other things, you know, which may or may not be dangerous, and it. And one problem with that is when we use that as a jury instruction, it kind of makes jurors think, well, knife's not necessarily a dangerous weapon. Well, if somebody, you know, I mean, seriously, a knife's not a dangerous weapon. So anyway, depends on the circumstance. I get it. So anyway, that specific reference to a knife was deleted, which is helpful. But the factors, there's now a list of factors to look at and to decide whether this object that the person has is a dangerous weapon. First, you look at the location and the circumstances in which the object was used or possessed, the primary purpose, what the thing was made for in the first place. I mean, nunchucks, you could say, no, I use that to roll out bread dough or something. Well, not really. And also, but also added to that, you could crack large walnuts with them, couldn't you? I don't know. I think Chris does that most of the time. Whether the manner in which the object is used or possessed constitutes a potential imminent threat to public safety. And we had to talk like crazy to get that, instead of being an extra element, to get that just into the list of things to be considered. So, you know, that has always been kind of a de facto thing that people look at. So the fact that this guy had the steak knife and was cutting a steak at home after he's been convicted of a felony, you know, really, no, okay, we're not going to be prosecuting something like that. But anyway, now it's going to be just maybe a little bit more difficult in some cases, but they'll just have to take that into consideration. Can't help it. This was really a popular bill, and everybody liked it and said, yeah, this is really important. I guess they were thinking that it was important for people who are restricted persons. And it was really funny. One guy was in there saying, he needed this to help support his family. You know, he needed to go hunting. And I'm thinking, you know, can you really support your family hunting without poaching? I have some real question about that. Maybe so. And I know when I was in law school, we ate an awful lot of venison, but it was all legal. Anyway, there is one thing, though, that we were able to get in there. And that was that if a judge or the Board of Pardons can use as a condition of probation or parole or pretrial release, as a matter of fact, the a prohibition on possession of archery equipment, including crossbows. So there you go. Now, Chad and I have been thinking about it, and we think that probably the real reason behind this, wanting everybody to be able to have a crossbow, is in case we are attacked by
zombies.
Zombies. We know it. We knew it all along.
It's bound to happen.
Exactly. Okay, we know that there is a case out in the basin of a guy who held maybe some of you who are listening to us right now at bay with archery equipment, and in fact shot at his neighbor with a crossbow. not very nice. I did mention, in fact, that they really ought to give this a little thought, because archery equipment with a nice sharp broadhead will shoot through a will shoot through a Kevlar vest. Now, what we've done, we're now on location in the firing range at the Post Academy, and Chris has set up a block of ballistic gelatin, and Chad is placing in front of it a yes, that's it. It's an old vest, okay, but not too old, okay.
Right.
And it's right over the okay, and Chad is getting back. Okay, he's about 15 yards away. He has his crossbow. Boing! There it goes. It not only went through the vest, it penetrated 8 inches of ballistic gelatin. Whew, boy, I'll tell you, these field exercises are really something. Anyway, so speaking of disorderly conduct, that moves us over to... in truth, folks, a broadhead will go through a vest, which is always a nice thing to go. And I'm sure that some of you thought about that when you were out having fun interaction with Mr. Weaver. So, House Bill 276, disorderly conduct. This is essentially an open carry bill. Which, when you get right to the end of it, doesn't change Utah law one whit, but it does at least make a restatement of it, which made people very happy, and is one of those things that gets argued over forever without really making any difference. But there you have it. So what it says is the mere carrying or possession of a holstered or encased firearm, whether visible or concealed, without additional behavior or circumstances that would cause a reasonable person to believe the holstered or encased firearm was carried or possessed with criminal intent, does not constitute a violation of this section. This, and there you go. It says nothing in this subsection may limit or prohibit law enforcement officers from approaching or engaging a person in voluntary conversation. Wow, momentous. But I guess at least it gives us a chance to think about it. If somebody's doing an open carry thing, you can go up and talk to them about it, but really you can't charge them with disorderly unless they're doing something else that makes them gives you reason to believe that they're doing something, that they're intending to do something downright evil. Okay, that takes us over to House Bill 290, which is really funny. There's an ad and put in there. Doesn't make any difference, but it's one of my favorite bills. Because we talked to the sponsor who is a Democrat and wanted to run a bill that would pass. And so just for fun, we went and asked her if she wanted to put this one in, to put an and, so that you have to have the culpable mental state and do the prescribed act. And so she did. Well, as it turned out, she also ran a couple of bills that were momentous. but anyway, there you go. House Bill 295, weapons law exemptions. This was run by, this one is one which will be of interest to you. this was brought to the legislature's attention by Post. And there are also issues that we got from Jared Eldridge, the Juab County attorney, told us about a case that he had. So we ran a few things and ran them all together, which turned out to be very interesting. Okay, the first thing is that there is an exemption for peace officers from the brandishing statute. When I say brandishing, we're talking about using, displaying a weapon in a threatening manner or using it in a fight or quarrel. Okay, it's been colloquially called brandishing for many years, so we'll just keep it by its nickname. And what it does, it takes out the overall exemption from the weapons laws. Regarding a couple of these, including brandishing. But in the brandishing, it says that the officer, that it doesn't apply to the officer who is performing his official duties. So the real question there was, what happens if it's a police officer who is in a in an instance of domestic violence and is threatening his domestic partner? With a firearm, do we really want them to be exempt? Well, duh, no, we don't. And if the only option to that is going to be aggravated assault, that's not really breaking in his direction either. So the only rational thing to do was to say, no, that exemption doesn't apply unless they're performing official duties. Now, that doesn't mean that you're on duty. It just means you're doing something that is part of your official responsibilities as a peace officer. Now, the next one was that there was a quirky deal in the statute that said that if a person is traveling through the state and has a firearm locked up in a case, that they're exempt from the weapons laws, even if they're a restricted person. Even if they've if they're convicted felons, well, that doesn't make any sense, and so we changed that around and took care of that issue also. A couple of other deals that we decided we'd take care of in in this bill, and that had to do with the definition of a dangerous weapon as it applies to the. Again, brandishing statute. We've had a real problem with this because we had that crazy definition about a knife. So that if you're charging somebody with threatening somebody with a weapon, you have to go back and talk about, well, yeah, sure, you threatened them with them, but think of all the wonderful things you can use. You can use a knife or Chris's nunchucks or whatever. Think of all the other wonderful things you can do with it. Well, that's absolutely dumb to have a jury instruction. And yet the defense could get that. And so we wanted to get rid of that. So there are currently in code two different definitions of dangerous weapon. And one of them is kind of a general one that applies in robberies and that kind of thing. And the other one has to do with those possession type offenses. And brandishing had the wrong definition applying to it. So we said, well, we'll go with the general one instead. Well, that didn't go over too well with some of the gun advocates, and they said, well, no, because there are some other things in that other definition that don't apply. So we said, well, you know, what's another definition of dangerous weapon among friends, right? So now we have yet a third definition of dangerous weapon. However, it's a very simple one. And you look on page 40, you'll see what it is. Dangerous weapon means an item in the manner of its use or intended use capable of causing death, serious bodily injury. And then your list of factors, the character of the instrument, the wound, if there was one, and the way, the manner in which it was exhibited or used. Very simple definition. Really solves our problem. The next one, House Bill 296, concealed weapon permits. this will only apply to judges or prosecutors or Board of Pardons members who may be listening to this, but that could happen. So what this does is allows for the revocation of those permits under the same standards of, as a regular CCW, and provides for a statewide requalification standard, which you folks at Post will want to know about because we're all going to get together and rewrite that standard. For everybody else, you're saying, what on earth is that about? And no need to know. Okay, House Bill 308, municipal ordinances. There is, has been a quirky thing in there talking about a minimum criminal fine that could be established by municipalities, and minimum has just been taken out. That's a technical fix, one that was important. And city prosecutors particularly want to take note of that. That has been fixed.
Okay, I'm just going to make a quick mention back on page 41 of House Bill 304 because we had a comment or question earlier about search and rescue operations. And House Bill 304 actually changed the statute that provides for approving a volunteer. Normally, a volunteer providing services to a law enforcement agency has to get the approval of the agency's executive officer and the personnel office with jurisdiction over that agency. So, you know, the city or wherever that the emergency situation is happening. This bill allows the sheriff alone to approve a volunteer to assist in a search and rescue operation or to do some activity in some emergency situation without approval from the local body. Anyway, thought I'd just mention that after that question that we had earlier. HB 392 at the top of page, I'm sorry, not 392. Let me do this other one first. HB 390, page 46. You won't see this too often, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, but in a manner of speaking, there are about four or five bills this year that the legislature passed that reflect upon the legislature's perception that they felt a number of things were going wrong in front of them during the course of an investigation into somebody.
And they found that hard to...
They found that hard to swallow, the things that were happening. So there is a brand new section called 36-12-9.5, Obstructing a Legislative Proceeding. This had not existed before, and it's meant to address some of these hard-to-swallow problems. And this makes a Class A misdemeanor if you are to testify falsely, make a false material statement, even if it's not under oath, to the legislature, House committee, subcommittee, or task force of the legislature. And then it has some other things in there. If you alter or destroy any item or thing, or you prevent a person by force, intimidation, or deception from performing any act that might aid the legislative proceeding, which I think means lobbyists ought to be very careful in the future. Anyway, all of those things would be a Class A misdemeanor. And interestingly, the bill clarifies that this new section 36129.5 is different from a violation of false or inconsistent statements in section 768503, and that's the statement that says that if you make a false statement under oath in an official proceeding, that's only a Class B misdemeanor. So in other words, if you're going to misrepresent yourself, it's better to do it in an official proceeding than before the legislature, because then it's a Class A misdemeanor. HB 392 at the top of page 47 is an interesting one. I won't spend more than 10 seconds on it, just to note that it says it's an actual third-degree felony, so it's a new crime, if a delegate that is elected to a constitutional convention disobeys the legislature. Then they go to prison for that. Powerful legislature we have. Man. HB 394, continuing with our theme of legislative stuff. It's another simple one that makes a Class B misdemeanor for certain violations of finance disclosure requirements. Doubtful that you'll come across that too often either. HB 399 at the top of 48. I just think this one's unfair because I had to go to school regardless of my grades. And this one says now that a local school board or charter school governing board may not issue a habitual truant citation to a school-age minor if the minor has a 3.5 GPA grade average and is at least 16 years old. So if you're 16 and you're smart, you've got a 3.5, don't worry about getting up in the morning. You don't need to go to school.
Of course, you want to have a 3-5 next semester.
Right, yeah. Exactly. It seems whatever happened to just good parenthood. Anyway.
I don't know. Kids these days.
Kids these days.
Kids these days. Okay, HB 411, victim restitution. This is to allow applying bail that's posted by a defendant to be used toward account receivable in the case. This brings up an issue which has suddenly raised its ugly head. And those of you in Davis County will know about it. And that is, there is a question of what about restitution for incarceration, the pay-to-stay business. I just want to point one thing out, and that is you'll see here that restitution, generally speaking, is to be collected in order provided by statute. And some jails are dipping into commissary accounts and other things first and putting themselves essentially ahead of the other collections. And so there's some question as to whether you're really following the statute. If you happen to be running a jail and you're doing that, do check with your county attorney. That's all I'm going to say about that one, because there could be an issue here, and that one's up and coming. So beep, beep, beep. That's just a red alert. Go ahead and talk to your county attorney about it.
Okay. House Bill 427 is asset forfeiture revisions, and I'm going to read this. This bill adds the crime victim reparations fund to the to the list of approved funding uses of the asset forfeiture grant program. Which program gets its entire funding from asset forfeiture cases, which cases are pursued by only the state's finest law enforcement officers and prosecutors? And I mention that because about 70...
why would that be, Chad?
Well, 70 to 80% of that fund is my own personal cases, and 70 to 80% of that fund probably comes from UHP patrol officers out there doing a good job.
So with that... humble notation.
Yeah.
We'll move on to Senate bills.
Excellent. Good transition.
And he's not kidding, folks. Senate Bill 13. Okay, interesting one. This is one that we've argued about for a few years, and it's interesting because this one actually has a kind of a scientific research basis to it. I'm sure that's a shocking concept. Originally, we had, in the past, we've had a situation where the third theft of a Class B level turns into a third-degree felony. And this is probably the first sentencing enhancement we ever had in the state of Utah. In fact, I'm sure it is, because when I first started, it was the only one. And, of course, they've proliferated since then. Well, what this bill does is, I'll tell you how it works and then after that why it works. What this does is says the third one is not going to be a felony from here out. It's going to be a Class A misdemeanor. Okay? Now, really, do we convict people on their third candy bar theft of a felony? No, we don't, as a matter of fact. And... generally speaking, if you're going for a felony because of repeated shoplifting, usually they've got 5, 6, 10, 20 shoplifting incidents before we charge them as a felony. So it doesn't make a huge amount of difference right there, but it is a tool. So changing it to a Class A, you explain to the defendant that, okay, it's getting more serious now. It's now a Class A misdemeanor. If you do it again, then it's going to be a felony. But there are some other things that were also put in here. And the things that were put in here were that if the current theft is the third one and one of the two priors or this one is a Class A misdemeanor, then it's going to be a felony anyway, third-degree felony anyway. Okay, so it looks convoluted, a little hard to read, but it's a fairly simple concept once you get it down. Now, there is another thing that's very interesting, and that is if you are once convicted of a felony theft, okay, or, as a matter of fact, anything from a list of prior convictions, once you get a felony theft or fraud, any theft after that becomes a felony, okay? So if you're out doing shoplifting after you've been convicted of a major fraud, felony, doesn't matter. It's going to be a felony every time. Okay, now the interesting basis to this was that we went out to, when I say we, the director of CCJJ and I and some members of the Board of Pardons all got very concerned about this because of the fact that these issues were brought up earlier. Went out and looked at a huge number of people who had actually been sent to prison on felony theft. And we found out that, as a matter of fact, the classic Jean Valjean, who steals a small amount of bread for his starving nephew, they just don't exist at the state prison. And people only get there after they've stolen a heck of a lot of stuff and screwed up on probation a bunch. So we knew that to be the case. But then we started looking at some other things. And what we found out was that if you look at the number of if you look at convictions and you look at enhanced penalties, if they go up a little with each conviction, the rates of recidivism seem to drop a little more sharply than you would expect. From somebody just growing out of it, and this was some research that was done at CCJJ. So we thought, well, then this gives us a very rational basis to go ahead and try something like this. So that's where that came from. We may look at it again in the future in some other areas. Don't we all feel edified on that one? Okay, now, page 58, this is big stuff, okay? No longer are we going to count on the Colorado blue spruce as our state tree. Now it's going to be the quaking aspen. Phew. Well, the quaking aspen is, you know, when you see these gigantic stands of quaking aspen, they're actually one organism, just that whole hillside.
Wow.
It's almost kind of scary, isn't it, to think about that? Wow. And that's why they kind of grow out. Well, I mean, what could be more important than quickly something that quickly multiplies being our state tree?
Well, that's probably why it's called a populus tremuloides.
There you have it.
Well, yeah, very good.
It's a, yeah.
Yeah. It's administrative subpoena modifications. Important bill for any of you that are involved in maybe doing investigations into internet crimes against children. Those folks in the basement on the internet that we were talking about earlier. Most important thing to think about, this is already in effect. It's been signed by the governor. So you may not use an administrative subpoena signed by a prosecutor any longer. That's already the law because this is in effect. For an ICAC-type case, you must obtain a judicial order from a court using the same basis, that is, showing reasonable grounds to believe that the records sought would be relevant to an ongoing investigation. Nonetheless, you must go to a judge before you can use such a subpoena to get the ISP provider information about the account holder, that sort of thing happening in a case under 7722 2.5, your children internet crimes against children type cases. So be aware of that. Don't make the mistake of going and getting information using a regular administrative subpoena because that evidence would be suppressed under this new law, which is already in effect. Turning
63. Scroll on down, folks.
Effective July 1, 2015, a peace officer or the Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division shall, without a warrant, which is nice, impound any vehicle that is being operated on the highway without the owner or operator's security in effect, unless the peace officer at the time makes a determination that impounding the vehicle would present a public safety concern, to the operator or to any of the occupants of the vehicle, or if you determine that impounding the vehicle would prevent you or the division from addressing other public safety considerations. So essentially, this is a much more mandated process to do the impounding of the vehicle that is uninsured unless you have one of these exceptions in play. It's important to note that a peace officer may not impound a vehicle if the operator is not carrying evidence of the security unless the lack of owner's or operator's security is verified through that UMID database. So you need to do that first. And if the operator is carrying evidence of their insurance and the UMID database indicates that the owner is not in effect, insurance is not in effect, then you need to not impound the vehicle without first making a reasonable attempt to independently verify that, in fact, the insurance is not in effect. So the bill also provides for a hearing and reimbursement process for a wrongful impound, so you have to be careful because this adds this additional process for a hearing and being reimbursed if you do wrongfully impound a vehicle under this section. Again, this one has two dates to be it was effective July 1, but this doesn't make any sense. It's actually effective, I think, July. I'm going to check it and come back. But I think it's January 1, but it says in the summary it's effective July 1. I didn't write the summary, but I think it's effective January 1. 2015, but I'll check that for you because it has both written here.
It does indeed. Very interesting. Okay. Now while Chad runs to the library, page 64, Senate Bill 88, Child Interview Amendments. A few years ago, we had some really awful things that resulted in a law talking about the showing of recordings of children at the Children's Justice Center. What happened is some of the perpetrators got hold of the tapes of a victim and of victims, actually, as it happened more than once, and essentially used them to re-victimize the kids. What a horrible thing to do. Sat around with popcorn and made fun of them, that kind of thing. And one of them ended up committing suicide over the thing when homicide would have been more appropriate. But horrible situation. So a bill was passed to deal with that. Unfortunately, it didn't really solve things quite as it should have been. And what we needed was to have more, we needed some serious clarification. And so that's what Senate Bill 88 is about. And here's the idea. It makes it a Class B misdemeanor across the board for displaying or distributing recordings of children made at a Children's Justice Center. Okay, now, that includes... if they were made at a Children's Justice Center and it's now in the possession of the police department, it doesn't matter. This criminal penalty follows that recording. So if you're going to distribute it, you still have to do it in accordance with this statute. So any of you who deal with these tapes want to make sure that you are carefully going along with this statute. And, of course, it's not always tapes because these are digital recordings that everybody's using now anyway. Okay, we had one problem, and that was that the GRAMA statute, Government Records Access Management Act, set up some defenses to crimes that that may or may not have applied because it was also classified as a protected record. So we took it all the way out of GRAMA, so it's not a record under GRAMA at all, and is controlled entirely by this. Then we have a list of people who can share these recordings with each other, okay? And that includes the police officers, human services, prosecutors, the Children's Justice Center, and others. So they're able to trade these things back and forth. If you deal at all with these recordings, make sure that that you review this and you go over it with your administration and with your legal experts on how you deal with these, because this one is important. It was effective March 28th of 2014. And the likelihood is, if you had anything to do with this, you probably already know about this bill anyway.
Senate Bill 92, at the bottom of page 65, a brief mention here. This is in your metal theft investigations. This will be helpful. It now adds, under the statute, you already have the requirements for identity requirements of the person that's selling the metal. And this now regulates that it applies to industries who refine or melt regulated metals as well. And then it mandates that the identification provided for the transaction be in the form of an ID provided by a state or federal government, not just their library card. Speaking of library cards, I did check the got back from the library, and it was a January 1, 2015 effective date on that last bill we talked about.
Nice segue.
Yeah, thanks. SB 108, Judiciary Amendments. Quick mention on this one as well. This was really just a long bill that was a cleanup for the courts, but it does make mention that for law enforcement, it requires that on any citation issued, it shall include whether the offense is a domestic violence offense. So that needs to be clear on your citation, whether or not it's DV related. Turning.
Are we droning on here?
I think we're droning on.
Sounds to like page 71.
Okay, page 71. This is a fun bill. Senate Bill 167 is the fourth of the search warrant bills meant to address all of the draconian law enforcement efforts
named
going
after
on out
Dracon.
There. After Dracon, who had a drone himself. Now, I'll point out that there was actually a legislator. This is real language from the. This is the kind of concern, so you understand how concerned people are with law enforcement. And this legislator said on the House floor, if I blasted that $1,700 drone out of the sky, would I get in trouble for that? If I see one in my backyard, it's going down. And so that was his actual sentiment. If a law enforcement agency were to use a drone, that he would shoot it out of the sky.
Preceded by a claim of being an experienced skeet shooter.
Yeah, that's true. And he kept calling it the skeet drone bill because he was hoping to legalize shooting them down like skeet. So what this says is if there is any time when you are going to use a drone as a law enforcement officer, in other words, you're going to send one up with a camera attached to it and try and obtain evidence by using something flying in the sky that is not being manned by an individual, so this wouldn't apply to helicopters that have an actual pilot, this is something else, then you must get a warrant under Rule 40. And the only thing that's annoying about this is that it means that I have to come up with another template by July 1 in the off chance that some officer out there decides he wants to send up a balloon or some kind of aerial vehicle with a camera attached to it.
Yeah, actually, this applies to ones that are in use. You know, if you've got these little remote control helicopters with a camera.
Yeah, just the smallest one.
Yeah.
How small do they get?
It was claimed they can get as small as a mosquito.
As small as a mosquito. So very difficult then to shoot down at that point, but in any case.
Chad, right above your head. Look.
Oh, got it. Got it.
Ow.
Excellent. Yeah. So please get a warrant before you drone on next time.
Cut that out.
Yeah. I think it's SB 177?
Personally, I plan on using calamine lotion to take care of, of the most of my drone problems.
Yeah, just spray some off.
Senate Bill 177, Sex Offender Registry. In the past, it's been very difficult when somebody is a sex offender and moves without registering their new address. There's always a question, where are you going to charge it? Where they left or where they turn up after a while? And this clarifies that and says that you can essentially do either one.
Okay. Page 76, SB 185 is law enforcement transparency. Following our theme that law enforcement is doing things that we need to know about, this bill was passed by the same Libertas, liberty-type folks that we've been talking about. So the first thing to point out is the middle paragraph there says, if the report is late, so we're going to be talking about a report that law enforcement is responsible to file, CCJJ will first make a courtesy call to you asking for the report. If the report is not submitted within 30 days after that courtesy call, CCJJ refers the agency, your law enforcement agency, to the House, the Senate, and the Attorney General. So, you could get in trouble, busted for not making this report. So what is the report? By August 1 of each year, CCJJ will prepare a summary of all of this data that is reported from agencies about a reportable incident. I'm at the top of page 77. What is a reportable incident? Well, it's any time that you use a tactical group, a special unit with a law enforcement agency specifically trained and equipped to respond to critical high-risk situations. Every state, county, municipal, or other law enforcement agency must, on or before April 30th, submit the annual report to CCJJ continuing the following data points. Whether the law enforcement agency conducted one or more reportable incidents. Again, this is a deployment of a tactical group or the law enforcement officer who serves a search warrant after using forcible entry. So you do this, you have one of these forcible entries, you must report after that title of the agency, the task force, or the group that was deployed during the incident, the city, county, and zip code of the location, the reason for the deployment, the type of warrant used, the threat, whether a threat assessment was completed, if a warrant was obtained, the name of the judge or magistrate who authorized it.
There we go again.
Yeah, it's great. And then the number of arrests made, if any evidence was seized, if any property was seized other than property that was seized as evidence, so cash maybe, something like that, if forcible entry was made, if a firearm was discharged by a law enforcement officer, and if so, at least they used it, approximately how many shots were fired by each officer. Do you feel lucky? So you're guessing, but did I fire five or six? If a weapon was brandished by
If you put in your report, enough.
Enough, yeah. If a weapon was brandished by a person other than the law enforcement officer, if a weapon was used by a person against the law enforcement officers, and if the firearm was used, the number, the approximate number of shots fired. So this is a lot of data points. Law enforcement was working with the sponsor to try and reduce this down to a manageable amount of data that would be reported, because this will be any time, again, that you use one of these forcible entries in a search warrant or you deploy a tactical group. Practice note at the bottom there, because the first report under this bill is going to be submitted next year for calendar year 2014, all law enforcement agencies should immediately prepare procedures for gathering and saving this required information, all required information for incidents that have already occurred during this year since January 1 should immediately be documented for inclusion in next year's report. So I guess that's where the estimated number might come in, because you're going to have to remember what's happened already this year. I listened to the committee hearing all this. I'm just going to mention this. At least there was one member of the committee who said, now, can we come back and visit this in a year? Because I'm not sure what this information is going to do for anybody. And I thought, yes, somebody gets it. So, anyway.
Well, you can estimate the number of rounds you need for next year, I guess.
Well, I guess so.
There you have it. SB 205, Controlled Substance Penalty Amendments. This puts a cap on how high you can enhance possession charges of controlled substances. Basically, it says you got to stop at a second degree. So you can't have possession of a controlled substance in a school zone blah, 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 repeat offense, you know, all kinds of stuff. So basically it says you can't go higher than a second degree because charging him with a first degree, although it's not done too often, is kind of, well, a bit much. Okay. Senate Bill 253 on page 83, distracted driver amendments. This essentially makes it makes it illegal to look at, to dial your phone while you're driving, to text while you're driving, to look up the
Paul
to look up yes
Paul, you with us? You with us?
Oh, sorry. I was texting. You know, I had an important call, and yeah, I got distracted for a minute. Did anybody notice?
No.
Okay. Anyway, it's according to my text here, it's a primary offense, and there are exceptions for reporting a safety hazard or for a couple of other things. But it is much more serious now. It's a Class C. With a $100 fine, and it's a it can be a Class B if a serious bodily injury was inflicted while somebody screwed up while they were texting.
Okay, last bill, Senate Bill 256, page 84.
And you will get your full 2 hours.
You will get your full 2 hours of credit.
At least those who are still around.
Good timing on this.
Deduct the time when you went out for pizza.
Yeah. So this bill actually began very scary, but it was reduced down to essentially three main points. If you do asset forfeiture cases, and I hope you do because only the finest law enforcement officers and prosecutors handle these cases, you'll take note of a few major changes. One of those being that a claimant now means an owner of property is defined, an interest holder is defined, or a person or entity who asserts a claim to any property seized for forfeiture. And that's not going to make too much of a change, but it might be important for some prosecutors to be aware of that. And certainly law enforcement, when you seize property you're going to forfeit or you think you're going to forfeit, you'll want to make sure that anybody who asserts the claim, you provide a notice to. Now, the main change to the law is this. The law enforcement agency shall promptly return seized property, and the prosecuting attorney may take no further action to effect the forfeiture of the property unless within 75 days after the property is seized, the prosecuting attorney either files a criminal forfeiture or indictment naming it or obtains a restraining order against the property, files a petition to give it over to the federal government, or files a civil forfeiture complaint. And what that's going to mean in real terms is currently the law says that you have 60 days to get it to us, the screening packet. And the prosecutor had 30 additional days, which gave us a full 90. Now your prosecutor only has 2 weeks, essentially, to get that complaint filed. There are some agencies out there who try to use the full 90 days, and they don't get it to us within 60 as currently required under the law. So that's not a good practice in the first place, but be aware that if you're one of those agencies, you can't go to 90 days, certainly, because it has to be filed within 75 in any case. The only other things it did there is it required notice be served for 2 weeks in a paper of general circulation, and then it reinserted all the requirements concerning a turnover order that your prosecutor has to actually file a petition for a turnover order if you want to send that property to the federal government rather than do a state forfeiture. 1159, and that is it.
Well, I know what you're all thinking out there. Could I shoot down a drone with a crossbow?
Perfect. Thanks. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chad. Chad Platt with the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office and Paul Boyden with the Statewide Association of Prosecutors for this presentation. It was a pleasure to have you here today at Post. I am Christopher Fielding with Post Technical Services, and we want to thank you to our live audience who participated today.